So the three of us are representatives of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and we're meeting with you today to ask you a number of questions about the financial crisis causes and your window on it. We'll go around and say who everyone is represented here. Today's October 28th. It's 20 to 6 p.m. And do we have your consent to record this interview?
Sure.
We were starting to discuss the reason we tape it is twofold. One, so that when we go back, to the extent we want to quote you accurately, we'll have it on tape. And then the second purpose is, since the FCIC was established by Congress and we are an official government agency, it becomes an official record of a federal agency, so it will be archived, and researchers years down the road can listen to it and have a sense of what caused the crisis and hear directly from somebody who was a participant.
So, Joel, this is Scott Alvarez. Can I interject one thing? I assume that this interview is subject to the confidentiality agreement that we have with the FCIC, so that the interview would not, and no part of the interview would be made public without notifying us in advance and giving us an opportunity to make sure that confidential information would not be released.
That's correct. The general counsel of the FCIC and you, Mr. Alvarez, entered into an agreement. So, yes, this recording would be subject to that. So let's go around the room, introduce ourselves from the FCIC. Joel Miller.
Tom Stanton from the research staff.
Alexis Simondinger from the writing team.
And I'm Dave Caperton with the Board Legal Division.
Scott Alvarez from the Board Legal Division.
And Kevin Warsh from the Fed.
All right. Governor Warsh, if you could provide us with a brief summary of your educational degrees you obtained, and then a brief summary of your career prior to coming to the Fed.
Sure. I was a Stanford undergraduate, studied political science and economics, and a major called public policy. I went to law school at Harvard, got a JD, studied law and economics predominantly. Did some additional work at the business schools in Cambridge at Harvard and at MIT's business school. Worked at Morgan Stanley as a mergers banker doing acquisitions and acquisition finance and capital markets for about 6.5-7 years, and then joined the White House staff in 2002. Served on the National Economic Council at the White House for about 4.5 years, and joined the Fed at the beginning of the Bernanke Fed, and came over 2 weeks after the chairman did in early 2006. So I've been here about 4.5 years as well.
Okay. And when we talk about the financial crisis, we're talking generally late 2006 through, let's say, 2009. So when we use that term, the causes of the financial crisis, for example, that's the period we're talking about.
I hope you've got your end date right.
All right. Well, we certainly welcome.
We're interviewing you.
Right. So I guess just to get us a sense of what you think some of the more important causes of the financial crisis were, if you could sort of get us started with that, a real macro view.
Sure. So much has been written about that question. I would say the conventional view, which may or may not be shared by the FCIC, is that it's about housing. I think that view is overly narrow. I think that view is too strictly drawn, and I would put it in a broader perspective. So in my view, housing and the problems in the subprime market were indicative. They were illustrative only of the mispricing of every asset virtually everywhere in the world. Reasons why housing manifested itself first the excesses around housing made possible by a whole range of private and public functions. Shouldn't surprise us that housing was the sort of early bell that rang, but this revaluation of every asset everywhere in the world that cascaded through markets and geographies strikes me as far more consequential than housing in and of itself. So my own sense of why the crisis is that the pillars that would protect economies from the crisis broke down. So in a word, why did they break down? I would say complacency is the word. And I would say that a narrative, which I also think is too narrow, much like the housing as the catalyst is too narrow, I think the narrative that regulators were asleep at the switch or some such expression misses the point. Doesn't mean that regulators couldn't and shouldn't be doing a better job, of course. But the pillars that protect economies from financial crises, from really dark situations, all broke down. And I'd say those three pillars are regulatory discipline, which has gotten a lot of the attention, market discipline, which has not gotten much attention, and capital standards, which I don't think have gotten a ton of attention. So those three prudential pillars all broke down, and all broke down more or less at the same point. And this is what happens late in economic cycles. So I would have a broader sense of the catalyst for the crisis, as well as the pillars that should have protected us, that I think is in the common narrative.
Was there, in your view, a precipitating event for these pillars to break down, or
time? So late in economic cycles, when market participants, that is those in the private sector and the official sector, come to the view that really bad things can happen, when measures of risk are very low is when risk is the highest. And so I would say the proximity of the last financial crisis to the moment of this one, and seeing that distance was the precipitating factor. Was there a particular event in 2006 or 2007 that was determinative? I don't think so. I have a different view of if you wanted to lay the most culpability on any of those events, where should you lay it? But I think that misses the broader point, which is the catalyst was going to happen. If it wasn't subprime housing, it would have been something else. If it weren't institution X, it would have been institution Y. And I think the preoccupation with individual proper nouns misses the broader story.
So is an economic crisis then inevitable?
So an economic cycle is inevitable. A response by the official sector is inevitable. But this kind of depths of boom and bust are not inevitable. But again, I'd say it strikes me that a narrative which I don't share has sort of captured the common attention. Again, I don't know what the views are of your group, but the narrative is that collectively we should be in the stability business, we in the official sector. I don't actually think that's true either. I think we need economic cycles. Economic cycles are part of what allowed the underlying strength in the economy to find their way through the system. So I think this notion of finding stability is a bit overdrawn as well.
How do you prevent a downturn economic cycle from becoming a crisis then?
So you establish these three pillars in a way in which one or two stand up when the other fall. So the pillars that are supposed to protect an economy should not all be subject to the same pro-cyclicality. So as an example, if markets get complacent late in economic cycles, that's when you need capital standards and regulators to stand up. If regulators get complacent, that's when you need markets to stand up. And what we find are these pillars are either all standing up or all laying down at the same moments in time. That is, the financial architecture has put them all in a position where they are subject to the same underlying incentives and trends. And the challenge for policy is to put each of those, not so that they are all working perfectly at all times. There's an aspiration that, in my view, is not readily accomplishable. But you set them up so that when one or two of them fall, the other one stands up. And I think if you look back over the financial crisis, they all fell at around the same time.
Did they all fall because they were all subject to the same, I don't want to say irrational exuberance, but to the same external factors? It's very hard to take the regulatory pillar for a regulator to tell a company that's making money hand over fist that something might be wrong with its risk management.
Yeah.
Capital all of a sudden gets weakened, or you look at the FDIC and banks shouldn't pay into the insurance fund because they've topped it off.
Right.
In other words, wasn't there a common driver that would, and then the question becomes, how do you make something a little less cyclical at the same time?
Yeah, so I think there are common drivers. Our public policy job is to find ways in which they stand up when others stand down. So I'll give you an example. If you look at the financial information, let's say the annual report and 10K of a big widget company in the U.S., of a big consumer products company in the U.S. I won't use an example, but just think of your favorite, what you think of as well-run company. And you spend a couple hours reading about that business. You're done with those financial statements and reading the annual report, and you're able to pretty quickly say, I understand how these guys make money. I understand what their risks are. I understand what are the trends and trajectories in their business. I can't predict perfectly how much money they're going to make next year. But I see the risks in their business through the eyes of their board and their senior management. Ask yourself the same question when you look at the publicly available information of a large financial services company in the U.S. or anywhere in the world. Compare a complex U.S. financial institution, a complex French, English, German financial institution, Japanese, Chinese institution. Spend hours reading that 10K and that annual report. You will not be able to answer those same questions. I wonder what the risk is of the business through the eyes of the risk managers and the board. Mm-mm. I wonder how they actually make their money. No, it'll be hard to figure that out. I wonder what their source of liquidity is and what are the risks around it. I can't figure that out. So, as an example, leading up to the financial crisis, if you believe in market discipline, and I am a market discipline believer, you'd say, well, markets can't just work out of nothing. Markets need to have access to information so that they are able to make informed judgments. And if they don't, we shouldn't be surprised that they get complacent, that market participants can get a little lazy, because getting a little lazy served them perfectly fine. Markets need to have information, and the official sector needs to make sure that information is available to keep markets on their toes so that all banks aren't painted or thought of with the same broad brush. That businesses, when they're thinking about their risks, say, our investors, our creditors, our stakeholders are going to think about these as well. And I don't think that in the generation preceding the crisis that market participants have had access to the information they need in order to make these informed decisions. Think about the Federal Reserve stress tests conducted in the middle of this. Why is it that they were perceived to be successful? So the conventional theory is, oh, because the Federal Reserve and the government said, we will provide government money if you can't raise it yourself. That's actually not why they were successful. Why they were successful is because for the first time in a very long time, long before the crisis, investors said, huh, so that's what the risks are. That's how they make their money. Those are their exposures. And that should be the model for how to provide information to markets not through stress tests provided by the Federal Reserve on a periodic basis, but that kind of information should be more regularly available on a quarterly and annual basis so that markets have information from which they can be good policemen. Now, that means if you have a long period of success and regulators end up being complacent, capital standards end up being low, you have a check. What we found is there was no check because everyone was drinking the, breathing the same air, seeing comparable information, and getting similarly complacent. So that's just one way in which you put them on different scales. You empower each of them, and you give them information from which they can make informed judgments.
Why didn't the markets demand that kind of information?
It's a good question. I would say around financial institutions, markets haven't demanded that for a very long time. I won't say forever, because if you go back to some economic history, you will see at different periods that markets demand information about Bank X or Company X. But in this period, they really didn't demand it. Is that in part because they came to the view that the information they were getting in these reports were vouched for and validated by government agencies who thought that this was good enough for them? Is it that they got a little lazy themselves? Is it that they outsourced some of their credit decisions to third parties like rating agencies? I think it's pieces of all of that. So if you were a pure efficient market hypothesis believer, if you believe that only markets have insight, you would say markets would demand it and there's no role for the rest of us. And if markets didn't demand that information from Big Bank X, nothing for us to do. That's not my view. My view is we need to encourage, persuade, even compel financial firms on an apples-to-apples basis to provide information to financial market participants, shareholders, creditors, stakeholders, counterparties, so they can make informed decisions. That you believe in market discipline doesn't mean that you don't think there's a role for the government in encouraging this information to find its way into the public square. And you guys can judge for yourselves whether or not reforms have been made around that so that markets can be making more regular, more informed decisions as opposed to one bit of information at one point in time in the Federal Reserve stress test.
We've perceived in a number of different areas a race to the bottom. Perhaps the easiest encapsulation of it is the Fannie Mae 2005 strategic plan, where an executive vice president said, we have two choices. Either we stick to our credit standards and lose market share, or we join the party and take more risk and try to manage it. And they joined the party. I've talked to a firm that didn't join the party, and they were really punished by the market because they didn't. They were giving the kind of disclosures you talked about. They had a much longer-term perspective. So I'm curious how in the market discipline pillar one deals with this problem in a cycle of the race to the bottom.
Yeah. So I think it's a tough one. I don't have an easy answer, but I would say if, for example, hypothetically, the government said these are the categories of information, this is how you need to provide it, this is the sorts of disclosure you want, Without being overly restrictive, these financial institutions are in different businesses. They have different risks. But if the government were to say, for example, the SEC were to say, we don't really think that investors can make an informed judgment between Bank X and Bank Y, and that was the new standard, a new standard of disclosure, if you want to be a public company, which, again, protects your proprietary competitive positions. We aggregated our stress test information such that some people would have liked it disaggregated, but we think we protected those that had particular positions in some markets. But if you set that standard, well, what would investors do? Investors would look at the one who you described as providing information, and if someone else had this template, they similarly would have to provide it. Then investors are empowered to ask hard questions. But if one provides it and the other doesn't have to, the others can be filled with a bunch of legal, generic risk factors that could apply to any financial institution. then you haven't given the investor an opportunity to have a race to the top. So if you think even in this environment in 2010 about those financial firms that are perceived by market participants to have superior risk management, the improvement in their disclosures are significant because investors have asked and they feel comfortable describing their risks, describing their own view of what their challenges are, and the others don't have to go along with it. But if the SEC said, this is the new model, this is how we'd like information shared, I think you have a chance of having a race to the top, where those that go forward and describe their risks, proactively describe how they're dealing with them, those get rewarded in markets, rewarded with higher multiples in the equity market, rewarded with lower risk spreads in the credit markets. So I think there is a role to be played by government officials to make sure that this market discipline pillar isn't relegated to the ash heap of history. And I worry that the market discipline pillar has been discarded because people will say, I think quite with some understanding, markets let us down. Markets weren't very good policemen. And as a result, they might say, so we can't ever trust market discipline to help us. I think that's the wrong conclusion. I think it's the right diagnosis. Markets let us down. They didn't help regulators police these firms. They didn't help distinguish between the stronger and the less strong. But it would be wrong then to say we're going to give up on that pillar. And, you know, your commission, I think, could do a good service by saying whether that pillar is a valid pillar that is part of this new architecture or whether the sort of conventional view is, well, the markets are just a bunch of, you know, greedy hedge funds and they don't have any value to give. I think we can learn a lot from market pricing, but that's only if markets have information. Otherwise, the signals we get don't inform us, don't inform regulators who need access to other information besides what we get from firms themselves to do our jobs so that regulatory discipline can also be more successful.
I'm sorry, I need to ask one more question if I may. Forget about the allegations markets are greedy. What about the allegation markets are, or at least a large number of major players, are very short-term in their orientation?
Yeah.
So if I can do capital arbitrage and increase my returns on equity, the present value of that return to me is good enough that everybody along the line benefits. The company has a higher ROE, the managers get paid more, everybody's happy. How does one deal with that aspect of market discipline?
So I think the recent history in the last generation of financial markets have creditors and shareholders who have similar investments and different investment horizons. So that there are some holders in credit or in equity that have a very short-term orientation, that have an investment horizon of hours, days, or weeks, is not dispositive. If you only had short-term oriented investors in your credit or in your share price, you could see why it would be difficult. But I would say if I look now at financial firms, they have a mix. And the participation in their securities of those that have longer horizons, even if that's a fraction of the overall base, is enough. And what I think most of these firms have recognized, and over the history of financial firms have long recognized, is the most important asset they have anywhere on their balance sheets. The most important they have anywhere is not on their balance sheets. It's their reputations, their credibility. And if you have a management team, if you have a board that's going to be around for 10 years, they will have their day, and they will be rewarded for doing the right long-term oriented decision. If you have leaders of these firms that are looking to check in and check out, we have a problem. But I think the leadership of these firms tends to be at least through a cycle. So their incentives should be similar to the broader economy, which is, what are we going to do over the horizon? The number of firms outside of financial services that have matched quarterly earnings for several quarters, even several years, and then had a big miss, have done great harm to their firms, their shareholders, their creditors, their reputations. So I don't really buy the notion that markets, that we are stuck with a short-term orientation by markets, both because of the investors and the managements. I think the time horizons of 5 to 10 years should be enough to do a lot of our work.
So during the years leading up to the crisis, you didn't see a focus on short-term benefit, either in terms of compensation or in terms of investments?
Sure you did. Sure you did. So late in economic cycles, economic history tells us that happens. You overweight the good and the immediate. You underweight the long-term and the urgent. This is the history of booms and busts and bubbles since the beginning of time. So late in the economic cycle, you see firms that are trying to outperform the next week, the next month, and the next quarter. And there are agency problems within firms where they think that they have to compete to do that. Absolutely you do. I don't really know how to fix that entirely, but I would say if we armed market participants with information that's not just what is my EPS going to be this quarter, but this is my EPS this quarter, this is my guidance, and here are the risks as I see them, you're more likely to have investors that have a balanced approach. If they don't have to talk about the risks as they see them, they don't have to talk about their sources of liquidity, the risks in their capital base, then markets and management will only be preoccupied on the short term. So, again, I don't mean to put all of the burden on market discipline, but relative to what strikes me as the narrative, which has gotten a lot of attention, I would say market discipline has a much bigger role to play than I have taken from sort of a lot of pundits that have been looking at this since the beginning.
And the agency that would be the principal one that would ensure that there is greater disclosure of these risks would be the SEC?
Yes.
About the other pillars.
Yeah. So let's go to regulatory discipline next. So I would say if you look at the financial crisis and your view of it is it's a global financial crisis that happened to find its way into different geographies at different times. But if you believe what I believe, which I don't think is the more common narrative, the common narrative, as you guys know, is it started in the U.S. and the U.S. problems spread and hurt these other countries. These other countries in the financial systems would have been just fine but for U.S. subprime mortgages. This, I think, is a common narrative, and it's a narrative that's shared in financial capitals and in the official sector in many other advanced foreign economies. So if you believe that narrative, well, if you just didn't have the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, there wouldn't have been a world war. If you didn't have subprime mortgages, there wouldn't have been this global financial crisis. If you're in that view, none of this is relevant. But if you have my view, which is it's a global financial crisis, the globally financial firms came into this with many more similar problems than differences. They came into it with very little capital relative to their risks. They came into it with short-term funding that was at risk of drying up. They came into it with markets that didn't really understand their businesses. And they came into it with regulators that relied on the next period looking a lot like the last period. I think I could make that diagnosis of the banking systems in virtually every country that has a major financial center. I could say that about the UK, I could say it about Europe, I could say it about Japan, I could say it even about China. So I think that was a universal truth. So what about regulatory discipline? If you look at these different financial centers, so in my mind, guys, I'm thinking of Tokyo, I'm thinking of Shanghai, I'm thinking of Hong Kong, Frankfurt, Paris, London, New York, I'd say all different regulatory structures. In some, the central bank was intimately involved in regulation. In some, the central bank was far away. In some, there was a single regulator. In others, there were multiple of regulators all competing with different borders. In some, there was an ethos, it is said, towards deregulation. In some, there was a view of, no, we in the official sector need to micromanage those banking systems. So you look at those different institutional structures, I see real differences, yet I see the same mess. So what does that teach us? That doesn't, you can take this too far and say, well, that means institutional structures don't matter. Institutional design doesn't matter. I don't believe that. But I would say, if you had the perfect institutional structure, that is, perfect arrangement of regulators, whatever your view is of what's the right role for the central bank, what's the right number of regulators to be policing, what's the right amount of business that should be in the shadow banking sector versus the regulated banking sector. If you did that perfectly, but you still came into this, so you had the regulatory structure right, but you had capital standards that weren't right, liquidity standards that weren't right, market discipline that wasn't working, you really wouldn't have solved this problem. So there are gains that can be had for a harmonized, smarter regulatory system, but I wouldn't put all of your weight on that notion. So regulatory discipline strikes me. It's more about what regulators do and how they think about risks than what their business card says, than how they're oriented one to another. And I think the recent history of differences there almost proved that point. So on regulatory discipline, I would say the structure's a piece of it. What's more important is how are regulators thinking about their business? How are they thinking about their jobs and responsibilities?
And how should they be?
So I hope you guys don't mind I sort of use the sort of foil of what I think is the common understanding and then try to refute it. I don't know if it's useful for the writer or for the analysis. So the foil in this discussion is you just needed more cops on the beat. You need more people to be regulating these complex institutions. If there were twice the number of people in large bank X, if they had more funding, if they were looking at the non-banking subs, if they were looking at consumer protection and safety and soundness, then you would go a long way, the conventional wisdom has, to fixing the problem. And so if we look at regulatory reform across big foreign advanced economies, that's the direction it's going. I don't know what's the right number of people. I don't know that the right number was right before or is right now. But I'd say what matters more is not how many bodies we throw at complex financial institutions, but what is more appropriate is what questions are we asking? In a simple framework, I would say I'd rather have two or three smart, cynical people that are asking the CFO and chief risk officer, are asking a couple key members on the board fundamental questions about, tell me about risk in your business. Tell me about what could go wrong. And when that chief risk officer says, well, my VAR model says X, and I've managed the risk this way, and they use a lot of expressions and words and complexity, I think you want a regulator that says, yeah, I know you said that to me, but I still don't really understand. Tell me again. So, again, this is not to suggest that we don't need larger, more comprehensive skills, talents. We don't need to look at at the affiliates that are inside the bank versus outside. But I think you need the disposition to be skeptical, to understand and probe. And one additional skill that I think you need. So my view of good regulation, which, you know, again, I don't know if it's in the common narrative. My view is the best regulators become the best regulators by seeing practices across a large group of institutions. So you don't need to understand risk better than the chief risk officer. What you do need to do, though, is you need to say, you know, I just looked at 12 firms that are in that business. And I came away from those 12 with a pretty broad sense of who was the most capable and competent, who seemed to understand the risk, who had a dashboard that was most operative. And at the other end of the spectrum, I saw folks that didn't seem to really know what was on their dashboard, didn't seem to have integrated, comprehensive risks across various businesses. So you, the regulator, don't need to have had the perfect dashboard, but you need to have visited them all and said, see that one which I thought was the most comprehensive, where the financial team at the institution could explain it to me the best. And when I kept asking dumb questions, they could keep going deeper. I want that to be the best practice for all of these firms. So good regulators need to be in the business of sharing, persuading, and learning from the broad remit so that all can be at a higher standard. And I think that is pretty essential as well. So it's a disposition. It's a broader remit. It's a certain amount of cynicism that grows the better the world looks. You know, I have an old expression that I've used in a speech, which says, the job of a central bank, the job of a regulator, is to be worried when the world isn't. And in some ways, in the toughest periods in the last 4 years, when the world was very worried about a lot of things, that should give us some comfort that at that moment in time, we don't have to be quite as worried about that. We should be thinking about we are at the greatest risk. Regulators are at the greatest risk of missing things when everyone else thinks things are swell. So the expression, which I'll borrow from Mark Carney, who's the head of the Bank of Canada, former investment banker, like me, says, risks are highest when measures of them are lowest, and I think that's true. And so regulators need to be looking at a broad set of what the risks are in the system. Look at the VIX in the stock market. Look at something called the move in the credit market. Look at a broad range of indicators of volatility. And when they're very low, that regulator should be even more cynical, asking even tougher questions. And if he can't get the kind of adequate responses from his regulatees, he needs to go back to headquarters and say, I'm not sure I understood what they were saying, but they didn't seem to appreciate the risks that are in their business. So this is just, I think, ways in which regulators can be more effective. And that might or might not be associated with more resources, different business cards, more agencies, oversight councils. I don't mean to dismiss the importance of it, but I would say you could do all that perfectly, but if you haven't changed these dispositions, you haven't fixed these fundamental questions, you might not have done as much to fix this regulatory discipline pillar as you think you did.
Sure. You were talking earlier about how the regulatory pillar was a little bit overdrawn, you think? You said that at the beginning, right?
So.
In our public discussion. But you just described a situation in which you're saying that regulators failed.
So I think I disagree with a couple premises there. So I think in the common narrative, a lot of burden is being put on the regulatory discipline pillar to the exclusion of complementary pillars like market discipline. But I would say real work needs to be done on all three pillars. None of them, to me, look perfect.
So let's just talk about the regulatory part.
I think
so the regulatory part, here we are in this terrible mess, the regulatory, you just described this situation in which there should be this level of scrutiny.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
So I think I'd challenge that a little bit. So
it worked great.
So is this your interview or mine? Oh, okay. So I'd say a couple things. If I look at regulation in the U.S. by the Federal Reserve and all of our brother and sister agencies, plenty of areas where it could have been done substantially better. If I look at regulatory efforts in all those other countries I talked about, same thing. So yes, I think it could have been done substantially better. I think I would say the reform, though, is not just about institutional design. And I think the encouraging thing to me about the Federal Reserve, you guys can judge other agencies better than I can, is that we have asked ourselves these hard questions. So as an example, how do we embed in our regulators the kind of skepticism? How do we make them feel more comfortable talking to the chief risk officer in times and say, you know, I don't really understand that. So I think one of the things that we've done is we've said to our finest economists who don't have on their business cards supervision and regulation, and said, it's really important that what you do informs our judgment and supervision. So I'd say that's a change in mix in skills, but it's also a change in mix in disposition. I don't know too many economists that are shrinking violets. And I think one of the things that we've done here, which is very encouraging, is we have said to our finest economists, part of your job is really informing and improving our supervision. And we have the benefit of already having these people with Federal Reserve business cards, even if they don't have business cards as a supervision. So we've created a new group. Scott would know whether it's public or not. Called an Office of Financial Stability, and we are staffing it, in the process of staffing it, with some of our finest talent. And that's in part to make sure that regulation isn't only done by supervisors. Regulation is done by the Federal Reserve. So we are in a range of businesses, from clearing half of all the checks that are written to high economic, macroeconomic analysis to inform monetary policy. And I would say our credibility comes from all the things that we do that are called the Federal Reserve. So we aren't tolerating, shouldn't tolerate, can't tolerate letting these businesses be siloed. So I think that's one of the ways in which we're making pretty substantial improvements. And I'd say the ultimate test will be when the next cycle comes, as it inevitably will. And I don't think that it's a fair aspiration to say that the regulatory community will now bring financial stability if that is to mean that we will ensure that the business cycle is eradicated.
How about confidence?
In what regard?
You were saying it can't bring stability necessarily, but what about confidence?
So I wouldn't want it to bring misplaced confidence. So I think fundamental comprehensive regulatory reform is important, but in and of itself, it's not enough. I think the risk for any policy, regulatory policy, monetary policy, consumer protection, is overpromising and under-delivering. I tend to think that we would all be in good stead in Washington, underselling what is accomplishable, developing our skills. This isn't going to happen overnight. And by the time that we have to deploy these skills, then surprising on the upside, what a decent job regulators did. What a helpful job markets were to inform regulators and inform banks so that they reacted earlier. How capital came into the capital structure in time to offset losses. So I would be hesitant to suggest that our message to markets, our message to investors, our message to banks is that we've got this thing all figured out, nothing to worry about. I want markets. I want boards. I want shareholders. I want rating agencies to be cynical, to be asking hard questions. And so long as they aren't detrimentally relying on some gloss of confidence from us, I have some confidence that at least for a while, they will be good policemen.
I'd like to ask a question because we've interviewed enough supervisory staff now to get a sense that if you're a small bank or a medium-sized regional bank, it's relatively easy for the examiner to give feedback and to bring lessons from peer groupings to those banks. And often senior management is very eager to learn from the regulators. But when you get to a large, complex financial institution, very often it's a much more difficult task in sheer political power terms. What have you done at the Fed, or have you looked back and analyzed that, but going forward, to back up your examiners who may need to bring unpopular messages to leaders of large institutions?
So I'd say two things, one on the data front, one on the status front. So on the data front, coming out of the stress tests, where We looked at institutions, including institutions that we did not have a lot of pre-existing knowledge, institutions that had come under the umbrella of the Federal Reserve only late in the cycle. So coming out of that, I think first we have informed and educated our staff about the comparability, about how to look on an apples-to-apples basis across firms, so that when they show back up at the firm that they're regulating, they are confident that they've got data to support them, that they've got knowledge, so it's not just an opinion that can be disregarded. And I would say, building on the successes of the stress test, we have a new process called the LISCC, which you know what it stands for better than I. Large Institution
Supervisory Something Committee.
Capital Committee?
Maybe Supervision.
Credit Committee. So we have a new I would describe it as a macroprudential group that's looking at the risks within financial institutions, across financial institutions, and more broadly. And that has got more people spending more time on that where prior to the crisis they didn't think that was their day job. So that's the example of these economists who now realize that macroeconomics and supervision are connected. So I would say you have a change in mix of talents, knowledge, expertise, conviction from those folks. I'd say secondly, the Federal Reserve has, for these large institutions which you asked about, I think spent more time with more of the reserve banks who have delegated authority in overseeing them, getting ourselves comfortable with the decision, the analysis, etc. So I'd say there's been perhaps a larger role coming out of the financial crisis for some mix of knowledge, talent, abilities between reserve banks and the Fed, between the reserve banks and the board. But I would also say perhaps equally, the financial crisis caused these agencies that tended not to share as broadly as they should about individual institutions and classes, they got in good habits during the crisis that they had to share. And I would say it's encouraging to see that there is more information sharing there too. So, and I don't think that didn't wait for the regulatory reform bill. I think that happened because of the relationships that were born, so I think that helps as well. So I think that's a mix of how you improve the bottom-up and top-down oversight over these firms. But I wouldn't tell you that we yet have a panacea for it. I'd say one other thing, Tom, about large firms versus small. So if you see these things first through the prism of market discipline, and I must stipulate to a first instinct of mine on these, if you've created firms that are in different classes and will always be in different classes. So think about community banks in one tier, regionals and super regionals in another, big money center banks in a third. I think it is a great virtue of the U.S. banking system, historically and going forward, that we have such a large number of institutions in different classes, and that's quite different than all of our peers around the world. But what is at least as important is having the boundaries between those three classes, in my stylized example, be very porous, be very permeable. Small firms can grow up to be big ones, and big ones can make errors and become smaller ones. And I think the challenge of 2010 and beyond is whether or not we have a system where the permeability, the porosity among those classes is real. Markets aren't so sure. The sooner markets come to the view that big institutions can fail, or short of failing, big institutions can make errors, and the creditors and shareholders will pay for it, the better off we will be. We still have the most dynamic banking system in the world. It is still a wonderful thing that we have 8,500 financial institutions. That virtue holds if some of them can compete and go up in their classification. The alternative is a small number of institutions that dominate the banking business, and if you look at many countries in Europe and in Asia, that's what they have. I think that is less helpful for the macroeconomy and less helpful for the real stability of the financial system to have a small number of institutions with dominant shares that they can never lose. So we need a system where we still have the rise and fall of the banks.
Although the Fed's actions, the way, at least it may be a narrative that we need to discard, seem to have preserved the debt holders of many large complex financial institutions that in fact failed, at least if you look at their net worth. And I guess I would ask your opinion of Walter Badgett's precepts in that context, where they simply set aside for purposes of the emergency, or were we going to let insolvent institutions fail with the implication not only shareholders would be affected, but also debt holders?
Yeah. So a couple of points. First, if you ask shareholders of these large institutions that got into a lot of trouble whether their institution was too big to fail, they would say no, because they took major haircuts. Now, there's still a fight about whether $2 is better than zero or $10 is better than zero. But if you care about it the way I do, which is, did markets inform, and will the memories of that market informing by changing prices change investor behavior going forward, I would say that the narrative isn't a terrible one. On creditors, I think it is different. So first, I'd modify one of the things you said, Tom, which is the Fed. The Fed is the one that stood behind the creditors. I'll now make a distinction. So under Badgett's sort of principle about lending at a penalty price against good collateral, that I would say is the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at cases where there was an institution that got in a lot of trouble, where we did use our 13-3 authority, find unusual and exigent circumstances, say there was no one else willing to provide, and could we get our hands on good collateral, I would say, yeah, we followed Badgett there. And we gave those creditors time. We didn't bail them out, meaning if after giving them time those assets weren't anything, they would have lost some money. I would say that is the long-held role of central banking, and I don't think lender of last resort authority, we've seen reason why that needs to be taken out of the Federal Reserve toolkit. Now, there are other institutions, though, that don't fit so soundly there. But I would say the Fed didn't have the authority, didn't have the money on the fiscal side to take losses. And I would say other agencies of the government, not without the knowledge of the Federal Reserve, but other agencies of the government, the Treasury, the FDIC, and others said, yes, we will stand behind the credit. So I on that piece of it, I don't think it's fair to ascribe that to the Federal Reserve, other than it was our knowledge. We knew they were doing it.
It was a team effort at
right,
that point.
Right.
Okay. Can we go to the GSE? Oh, we haven't gone to capital yet, which is okay.
I just wanted to ask one more question, and then let's do GSEs.
Okay.
Don't want to lose sight of those. Tom had asked a question a few minutes ago about, I guess, a perception that the largest banks perhaps are treated differently than the regionals and the community banks. And if you look at the enforcement actions that the banking regulators have brought over the years, I mean, it's not just a numerical difference because there's so many more community banks, but there tend to be more formal actions against the smaller banks, especially during the years leading up to the crisis. We now have the exam reports for some of these institutions in the public record, and I guess why weren't actions brought? Why wasn't the board of directors of some of these largest institutions, why wasn't their attention gained in some way?
So let me begin by answering that by what I should have said to Tom and Alexis before, which is, I'm not on our supervisory committee, haven't been in my 4.5 years. So individual institutions, and the policies. They might come to me, like my colleagues, for a notation vote about bringing enforcement action, but I was not on the front lines of those decisions. I don't mean to sort of walk back from responsibility. We all have responsibilities at the Fed, but I would say I'm probably not the right person to give you any informed judgment on why more small than large. I have a perspective, but it's not borne out from meeting out those decisions. I've got colleagues who you may or may not have spoken to who have that. The institutions I was involved with were Sunday night institutions in the middle of the financial crisis. So it would be fair to say that I was not there perceived to be or really involved in that institution and the individual problems of that institution before, in some ways, it was too late. It's just we all have different responsibilities here. Mine tend to be on financial markets, tend to be on sort of our organization. So that's just a firm but accurate sort of disclosure. So now I'll give you my intuition to small versus large. I don't know the data, but if you looked at the denominator of small institutions and you looked at the number of enforcement actions, I would bet that that ratio is a very small one. You looked at the denominator of very large institutions, it would be a tiny fraction of the denominator of small. So you're going to have to judge for yourselves whether there's equality in comparing those statistics, point one. Point two, I agree with the premise that if a financial institution is large and complex, and regulators can't understand it, that we ought not tolerate that. So if a financial institution takes you through all their work and we ask the cynical questions, they can't convince us that they understand. I said in a speech on this, they have a presumption that they need to overcome, that they can explain to us the risks of their business. And if they can't overcome that presumption because they are so complex, they have such size and scope, then that is not a situation we should tolerate. So point two. Point three, for large institutions, which I must say I only have had a good look at from the Sunday night looking back, as opposed to all the Sunday nights that preceded it, I would say the purpose of actions are basically to get their and their stakeholders' attention. That's the purpose. The purpose is to make sure they're paying attention to risks. And in my view, making sure that markets know that they're paying attention to risks. Supervisors across U.S. regulators may have made judgments that they could get their attention plenty short of going public with a cease and desist order or others. What I would say is if they could get their attention that way, and we could see that we're fixing the problem, that's good. But again, if you have a market discipline view like I would say you need to weigh that against getting the market's attention. And where that balance comes on any individual firm is hard for me to judge, certainly in retrospect.
Okay. In terms of maybe what the underlying question was whether there was a reluctance on the part of the Fed to change the behavior of these mega institutions, to allow them to continue with whatever the new product du jour was. Do you have any thoughts about that?
So I honestly don't know, because what you're suggesting is that there were sort of quiet accords somehow between regulator and regulatee, in which case, to be candid, before the crisis, wouldn't have had a good look into. So I must say I just don't have a lot of knowledge to inform that judgment.
Shift to GSEs or GSEs?
Sure. I think there are some important issues on supervision, but you're not on that committee, so that's fair. I've just looked at one too many supervisory reports where the institution in 2006 was given a very good rating on its risk management, And in 2007, after it was shipping water, their rating was downgraded. And in 2008, gee, these guys really don't know risk management. It was very disconcerting to see that pattern. But
So I will say that pattern, which I am sure of the stipulation you just made, we see that also in rating agencies. We see that in markets. We see that in creditors, which is these are binary outcomes. And it's binary outcomes that the new financial architecture has to deal with. We can well deal with a company that is having problems, and slowly and surely they're having more problems. What is hard for the macroeconomy to deal with are when it's a light switch. Things are fine until they're not. Ratings are fine until they're not. We could handle all these sort of more modest deviations, but late in the cycle, we need to guard against these binary changes. So I'm not surprised by that in the supervisory realm, but I see that everywhere. That is indicative across all of these stakeholders.
I've got to share with you one marvelous quote from somebody. Financial firms die of a heart attack. Corporations die of cancer. Yeah. It's a different world. I mean, when liquidity risk hits, it is binary.
Yeah.
But let's go on to GSEs, your White House experience, because I gather you were heavily involved with GSEs. Why did Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac fail?
For the same reasons we talked about. They didn't have any capital, they didn't have any market discipline, and there wasn't much regulatory discipline.
Okay. And let's talk a little, and I don't mean to sound like Simon Johnson, but when you were in the White House looking at the high leverage of the GSEs, I mean, it looked, and I watched that legislation, the power of the regulated entity vis-a-vis an administration that was pretty serious about increasing capital was really striking to see. How does one include in the discussion of how to make improvements in the three pillars recognition of the potential political power of the affected institutions?
So I wish I could disabuse you of any that which you just said. So there was a small cadre of people in 2002 who looked at these two institutions, looked at the chronically low capital, the lack of market discipline, and a regulatory regime that was, to be euphemistic, very light touch. And then at institutions where all of the politics, or I should say nearly all of the politics, were pushing them to do more with less. Less regulation, less market discipline, and to go seek more profitability. So the administration, I must admit to being a part of this, saw this as a grave risk. The budget documents, if you're looking for any manifestations, that the OMB budget documents, 03, 04, 05, 06, stated very clearly that these institutions were highly leveraged. Their failures would be catastrophic. I'm not quoting, but paraphrasing. Would be catastrophic for the macroeconomy. And there were attempts by a White House to get to the bottom of it. The president took his directors off the boards of these institutions to try to suggest to the world that these were not special. If they were in the public markets, then they were going to have to make it by themselves. So I would say there were a series of efforts made. Efforts made to get them to comply at least with the 1934 Act at the SEC. I would say there were half a dozen moves in the right direction. Attempts to bring stronger market discipline and stronger regulation were rebuffed by not just the regulatees, not just the many members of the regulator, but by much of, even most of Congress on a bipartisan basis. So the administration's efforts 6 years before the crisis to get to the bottom of this did not ultimately succeed. And I think the politics have a lot to do with that.
Was there any effort made or any understanding of the linkages between the GSEs and the rest of the financial system?
So, yeah, I have memos, yes, a lot. There were CEA chairmen who worked with me and whose economic teams wrote and spoke and argued that these institutions and their failure is not remote and the consequences are very significant, and hence we need a stronger regulatory regime, we need more capital, and we need more market discipline. Just didn't succeed. So I would say the failure of some of these firms, or near failure of some of these firms, were hard to anticipate. And I would be the first to say that I didn't perfectly foresee some of the pullback in short-term funding markets. The failures at Fannie and Freddie were predictable and predicted, including by the Federal Reserve, long before I got here. And once I showed up and the chairman showed up, we continued the tradition of talking about the need for fundamental reform of Fannie and Freddie. And you guys can judge for yourselves whether or not fundamental reform was ever brought or is now in the cards. I don't know. I'm skeptical. So, yes, I would say there is nothing about Fannie and Freddie's failure that, virtually nothing about their failure that surprised me. In hindsight, in foresight, and anywhere in between.
Do you think the SCIC report should reflect that Fannie and Freddie were causal or complications?
So I would say they had an important role to play in the consequences. What I can't say is if you were to take their failure out, what would be the difference in magnitude? I don't know for sure. But I would say that their failure made the magnitude of the consequences of this period meaningfully greater. I'm just not sure I could define for you what meaningfully is. So I'd describe it this way. The most important weekend from the fall of 08, the fall of 08, and the most underreported between the common narrative and the reality was the failure of Fannie and Freddie, or the near failure. So why do I say that? You gave a boring speech on this if it's more articulate than I am. That was, I think, a weekend or two before Lehman weekend. Going into that weekend, in the 9 months before, and in the 9 years before, the 19 years before, people thought surely these institutions were backed effectively by the U.S. government. Why did they think that? Because the companies told them, and the governments, broadly defined, didn't seem to disagree. So the near failure of Fannie and Freddie that weekend, by which regulatory reform was far too late, that told the world that assets which in the world are perceived to be risk-free are filled with risk. No problem. And so that was the biggest shock, in my judgment, the biggest surprise between market perceptions and reality that could not easily be undone by overwhelming force from the government. Given where we were that weekend, I think that the Fed, the Treasury, others did the best they could, because what we knew in 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 was if these institutions blow up like this, we will have no choice. So this is not a criticism of the activities of that weekend. It's a criticism of the activities of the weekends for the 20 years before. But again, was this so consequential? The world were investors in the credit of Fannie and Freddie, from Asia through Europe through the U.S., and they own these because they thought there was a free lunch to be had. They get a little extra sweetener, a little extra spread above treasuries, not much, but the governments effectively backed them. And the governments had lots of opportunities to walk back from that. And the companies would say, oh, no, we're not marketing ourselves as though we're backed by the government. You see on our indenture it says this is not a backed by the government. It's a proper legal legend on each of the securities. But everything else said otherwise. So when the world thinks that a risk-free asset might not be and requires such overwhelming force behind them, the world doesn't know what's the value of any asset everywhere in the world. So if the world doesn't know what a risk-free asset is worth, well, you don't know what risk premium to put on every other asset. And I think this was a massive, underreported, underappreciated jolt to the system. large holders of U.S.-denominated assets overseas that held treasuries, real treasuries, and still hold them today. They know they're backed by the government. They came to be uncertain about whether these assets were actually backed by the government. And so the government did all they could to undo that perception, to convince them, well, we're actually going to back them now. What do you mean you're going to back them now? I thought they were always backed by you. And so that was a shock that caused investors to panic about the value of every asset, to reassess every portfolio. And so if I took that weekend out, if Fannie and Freddie were to have been fine throughout this process, there certainly would have been a lot of harm to the financial markets. There certainly would have been harm to the economy. But I don't believe it would have been of near the magnitude that it was because of that jolt. And that couldn't have been cured on a Sunday or a Monday.
I need to understand. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
The government stepped forward and basically assured the debt holders, MBS holders.
Right.
Why wasn't that a confidence measure in the week before Lehman rather than a jolt to the system?
Why do you need to have press conferences and new keep-well agreements and new securities if it was already backed by the government? You're protesting too much. Why is it in the period in which, in the several days before that weekend, think of a large holder of Fannie and Freddie securities. Think of a domestic version and think of a foreign version.
Foreign central bank, yes.
Think of these two institutions and think about what's going through their mind as there's all these questions about will they or won't they? Are they solvent or insolvent? Not easily cured by theater and funding on a Sunday night because you've introduced to them massive uncertainty. And yes, might they say, well, I tend to believe that, in fact, the government will support that asset. But what about every other asset? If they have to use such overwhelming force on an asset that was riskless, I wonder how much force they're going to need to do on everything else. If they in the official sector in the U.S. are so panicked that we're all going to run from this, I wonder what else there could be. So my view is that the role of, let me step back, the dollar is the world's reserve currency. The corollary of that is that the treasury securities, the treasury curve, is the most important price for every asset everywhere in the world. A very close relative of that curve was the Fannie and Freddie curve, because the same people were riding the treasury curve were riding the Fannie and Freddie curve. Everything else gets priced in the world as a spread to that. Risk premiums are spread to that. That weekend, what the government tried to do was assure that the spread on Fannie and Freddie didn't blow out. It ended up blowing out less than it otherwise would have. So the government beat that spread back with overwhelming force. But what happened to that uncertainty? Risk premiums, the other part of pricing for every asset in the world, blew out. So the uncertainty found its way into the risk premiums, even though it was mostly beaten out of the quote-unquote riskless asset. So if you look at the spike in risk premiums to everything else and the volatility of all measures of risk, you could see why an asset which is large, call that, you'll have the exact number, $5.5 trillion of assets, big in and of itself, why that can have far more impact than $5.5 trillion. So I think that was the most consequential event of the weekend. I don't think it's part of the common narrative because the reporting has it, well, the government cured that. So now go back to Fannie and Freddie in the 9 months and 9 years before that. More burdens were put on Fannie and Freddie throughout this period, even once the recession began. And as you guys define the crisis beginning, the end of 06. So ask yourself what burdens were put on Fannie and Freddie in 07 and 08 up until that September. More. They were told they have to do more because the narrative, you'll recall, was we have a housing problem. Oh, the good news is we have two institutions. They're effectively backed by the U.S. government. Can't they deal with the housing problem? They seem comfortable with it. The politicians wanted them to. So the institutions going into September of 08 were in a weaker position than even those same institutions were 9 months before, 19 months before, 9 years before, because they took on more burdens. They took on more risk because the thought was, we just have a housing problem, and we've got someone who can clean that up.
And who are you saying told them that they have to take on more?
So I would say their overseers in Congress. I would say their management teams thought that this was a good way to demonstrate their important role. So I would say almost everyone. So I wasn't there then, and so I don't really know. But I think if you look back on that period, their regulator, let me say that without saying their White House, because when I left, I really don't know what the relationship was. But their regulator seemed to be, let me put it this way, their regulator didn't seem to stop the burden being added to them. Where that burden came, I don't know. But the regulator did not say, as far as I recall, these institutions are not capable of doing more refinancings, finding new ways to start first-time home buyers. So I'd say, given my limited knowledge and recollection, the regulator certainly didn't stop these burdens from being placed on them. And their capital scarcely grew. So if you take on more burdens, but you take on more capital, I'd say, well, that could work. No, capital levels were very small. One of them, I can't recall which, had a small common equity raise in the spring of 09. I can't remember which. The other had...
Spring of 08. That was Fannie.
Yeah. They were both, I think, encouraged to go raise some capital, thinking that might be nice. I don't know who encouraged them. The regulator, the Treasury, I don't know. One of them succeeded, quote unquote. The other one didn't. But there was an opportunity for them to raise more capital. My suspicion is it was still too late. These institutions were not going to make it. And my concern then was more burdens were being put on them. My concern from 02 through that weekend was the best thing that Fannie and Freddie could do to help us get out of this mess is to survive. And the gravest risk is if they don't make it.
Can I ask you a follow-up?
So, just for question planning purposes, we're coming close to the end, so if you have those last few that you need to get in.
Oh, we thought it was 7:30.
Oh, no, it's 7:30. Sorry.
Oh. Okay. Well,
I'll try to be briefer in my answers.
We better do it following.
The third follow-up was on the conservatorship weekend. Do you have a sense, can you explain, how much thought was given to the idea of creating panic? How much discussion around, because that was very much planned out, Treasury, White House.
So in the couple of weekends before, mm-hmm. Their regulator and outside advisors that were hired by their regulator or Treasury, I don't know, looked at these institutions, and I was unsurprised that they concluded that these institutions were effectively insolvent. So during that, I think there was a genuine discussion about, given the risks that they hold, given the risks around the institutions, what bit of new capital and new support would be confidence-inducing versus panic-inducing. Mm-hmm. That question has been central to almost every extraordinary measure undertaken by all government officials throughout this period. And it's never obvious in solving a particular institution's problems, which you're doing at least in part, whether or not you are striking that right balance between reassurance or panic. My recollection then and my judgment now would be the world had figured out way too late that these institutions did not have sufficient capital. And you might not have had to have done that activity that weekend, but that was coming. You couldn't have avoided effectively backing these institutions through a commitment of guarantees and capital from a public source, given where we were in the cycle. Could you have held off for another month or two, perhaps? But in some ways, I would argue you didn't have a choice by the time you got there. You had a lot of choices for many years, but you gave up on having choices by not actually fixing these institutions for a very long time when a lot of very knowledgeable people that had done a lot of serious work came to that view. You'll recall, and Tom, I think you might have written about this in a prior life, you'll recall that the riff about Fannie and Freddie was the people that were trying to reform them were ideological. They were just trying to privatize them. They were only looking through this, saying that these institutions didn't have capital because they had some purpose, some malevolent purpose. Well, if you go back to the broader history, you guys should look at what the Clinton administration concluded in 1999 about Fannie and Freddie. You should not paraphrase me because I won't get it right, but if I recall, Larry Summers and others gave a speech for a very short period of time that said, there could be a problem here. So I would say that serious people that looked at Fannie and Freddie for a very long time saw this as a potential risk, but by the time you got close to it, you were kind of stuck with it. And the serious people that looked across administrations said, if you don't deal with this soon, you're going to have a lot of problems. I should just note one thing, and I'll give you an extra 2 minutes because this is my my clarification. Fannie and Freddie were set up with these perverse incentives. It has never been my view that there has been particular wrongdoing by any individual figures at these institutions. It's not something I would have known could come to any view, but they were set up with competing missions, confused objectives, and a hybrid model that is bound to end up with these problems. So I would say their institutional structure and incentives are what brought them to this place. And so those that were authors of, supporters of, and overseers are the ones that have the burden. It really not none of my views on Fannie and Freddie are about particular people. Those CEOs were told to maximize shareholder value, and that's what they did.
Can I shift gears?
Yes.
Still during that period in September, but after Lehman failed, what's your view on Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs? How close were they to going under as well if they hadn't converted?
So first, the easy answer is I don't know for sure. I would say in periods of panic historically, it's hard for the strong to distinguish themselves from the less strong. That's what economic history tells us. What by the time we got to that weekend, so when are we, early October?
Yeah, late September, early October 2008.
So by the time we'd gotten there, what you saw were markets that started at what they perceived to be the weakest and most vulnerable and weren't going to stop until they were confronted with what I describe as either overwhelming force or overwhelming facts. What they ultimately received, in some ways, was overwhelming force by changing their charter, by Treasury statements suggesting that these institutions will be whatever the language was from that press release that basically said these institutions would survive the night. The other alternative would have been, and so but for overwhelming force is your question, could they have survived? And I would view the changing of the charters as only one piece, one important but perhaps not determinative piece of overwhelming force. The other alternative is overwhelming facts. So could one institution, pick whichever of those two proper nouns that you mentioned, have said, we are going to open up the kimono. We are going to tell everything about our capital, about our liquidity, about validating investors, about our posture, about our risks. And in so doing, we're going to have to tell more than we want to from a competitive perspective. But this is very important. It's about our survival. So we're willing to show you our books. It's quite possible, in my view, that at least one of them, maybe both, could have provided overwhelming facts, so the market said, I know I've taken out, in effect, your weaker brethren, but I've seen enough, and I'm not going to take you out. So I think there was a potential alternative to that bit of force. And again, I would describe the change in the charter that in and of itself, I don't think it would have done very much. In concert with the full suite of actions taken by the Treasury, the FDIC, and others, I'd say it was part of that package. Hard for me to distinguish the relative import of any one piece.
Do you have any example in history, for that matter, or in other countries, where somebody has been able to use that strategy and succeed? One thinks of some of the companies at the beginning of the dominoes falling, where they stood up saying, we're not insolvent. And if anything, the market said, oh, you know, now we're going farther. Now, that's not the kind of disclosure you're talking about. But do you have any real examples of that works, that strategy working?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a couple from this cycle. And what I'm going to say to you is not my view, it's market perceptions. Market perceptions were that J.P. Morgan was going to be a survivor, that J.P. Morgan's risk management was superior, that J.P. Morgan's management team was sufficiently rigorous. And so if you looked at CDS spreads, if you looked at share prices, of course in the panic everyone gets bid down. But I think to answer that question, Tom, you want to look at the delta. Was everyone bid down the same, or was there a delta? And if you look at certain firms, J.P. Morgan among that class of institutions, Wells Fargo among more traditional, conventional retail banks, they were outperforming their peers even though they were feeling pressure. So I would say even in this cycle, you could see markets differentiating. My view is market differentiation is what's essential. When markets are treating everybody the same, we have ourselves a problem. So I think there are some partial examples, usually not because of new disclosure, but because of reputational perceptions, that Wells Fargo, markets perceived, was always a well-run bank. And that even in the case of Wells, markets perceived, they might have bought some assets that turned out not to be great, in particular institutions, but they were going to be fine. So again, I think that there are some examples where some differentiated, which gives some credence to the view that the tsunami wouldn't have taken out everybody. But again, you're making judgments under, not in hindsight, but at that moment. And I would say many of these judgments, to be clear, were not Federal Reserve judgments. These were judgments of the fiscal authorities. In the case of TARP, judgments of the Congress. The Federal Reserve had a role to play, but the Federal Reserve role was mostly about will we provide liquidity through the discount window, or in extraordinary rate cases, will we provide liquidity through 13-3 authority? And that was bounded by whether we could get our hands on collateral, whether we could get our hands on assets, such that we said we're going to get our bait back. We had to have a reasonably high confidence probability around that to make that judgment. And I think those judgments ended up being good ones. So if you look even at the most serious, the largest of these, and you look at the Fed's position, for example, in AIG, the Fed's position in that, I think, has always looked pretty good. The equity has, at different moments, looked better and worse. So I know there's a temptation to say the government writ large. And I don't mean to suggest that the Federal Reserve was not part of these discussions, but our authorities are bounded. Our conscience is bounded. And we could only do what we could do under the law. And so we exercised our authorities under 13-3, under our lender of last resort. But we didn't. We veered strongly away from doing more than that. It does turn out as though other government agencies may have filled in the gaps because they made judgments about their role and responsibilities, their charter. So again, when you're thinking about the narrative, I think it's useful to distinguish the Fed's role from others.
Last critical question or two before we...
Yes, sir.
Do you think it was truly a market perception that institutions like Wells and JPM were going to survive? Or was it the perception that, well, the government has made it very clear that those two institutions are going to survive because they were the acquirers?
Yeah, so there is no doubt that when a government writes a blanket guarantee that does good things for the strong, the mediocre, and the weak. All that I'm saying is that the question was, but for certain government actions, could any, like the strongest, survive? And I think it's possible. I don't know. But I think that's in part because of their idiosyncratic differences, partly because of their reputation, potentially their disclosure, because of market perceptions, such that markets perceived that some would survive, no matter what the government did. And I think if you look at financial market prices at that period, you could see quickly who was either the most likely to survive or the last to fail.
I have two quick questions. Do you have time for two quick ones?
Okay.
All right, here's one, quick.
Okay.
Take you back to 2006. Okay. Do you remember the bank guidance? The guidance that went out, non-traditional guidance you were around?
Is this the CRE guidance?
Mm-hmm. Commercial? No, no. This is
non-traditional mortgage.
Safety and soundness and consumer guidance.
So apparently I don't remember it.
Okay.
When do we know when it was in 06?
It was September. You were here.
So I would have been here. So I don't remember it, but I do remember a discussion ex post of that guidance.
My question was going to be, we were told that you opposed it, and I wanted to know why.
I don't remember, so it would be hard for me to remember that. That would surprise me.
So you don't remember. Well, tell me about what you remember afterwards, the discussion afterwards, if you remember it after.
Yeah, it was a few months ago. We were doing lessons learned. So we were evaluating.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Don Cohn subcommittee here that was looking at lessons learned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the conclusions, so now this is hearsay. This is from people that were working, our staff that were working on that report. They said that we came to many judgments that were right, but they weren't pushed with the force that in retrospect would have been good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think commercial real estate is one example which comes to mind, but that might well have been another example. Again, I don't remember.
Related to that, you sat on the CAC, and while you were at the White House, you did a lot of thinking about consumer protection.
Yes.
Right? You were a member of the...
No, actually.
The Fed CAC.
No, I was actually on that for 1 week. I don't think I ever went to a meeting, but I was put on the committee.
You're listed in the transcripts of having participated. That's wrong.
So the Consumer Advisory Council or our Consumer Committee?
The Consumer Advisory Council.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the Consumer Advisory Council meets. I go to meetings when I can. I've probably been to a third of the meetings in my 4.5 years.
Okay. So here's my question.
Yeah.
You've been to the meetings. You listened to the discussion. And you've heard from time to time over the period that you've been here, anecdotal and data-driven information about the housing situation, lending situation since 2006. So I'm just asking you, did you have yourself a growing concern of what was happening in the marketplace?
Starting in 2002, I had a growing concern, which grew every week from 2002 until the financial crisis, that the mortgage finance market was broken, and that the policing that's necessary in that market wasn't happening, and that bad practices were emanating in all areas. So would I have thought that consumers were not being fully abreast of developments in that market? Absolutely. I think you'd be hard-pressed, Alexis, to find somebody over these last 9 years or 7 years who were more concerned about the frailties in mortgage finance than me.
If that's true, though, why wouldn't you remember the guidance?
So, again, just to remind you, I was on the Consumer Advisory Committee, so we divide our responsibilities up here among 5 or 6 committees. I was notionally on the committee for 1 week, so that guidance would not have been probed by me. My sleeves wouldn't have been rolled up. It would have come to me for a notation vote. I would have read it. I could have well walked down the hallway and asked my colleagues who ran that committee about it, tell me about this or tell me about that. But it doesn't surprise me, given the number of issues upon which we vote opine, that I couldn't remember one notation vote. But I don't think I've convinced you of what I am convinced myself, which is mortgage finance and the problems in mortgage finance were so serious, had been serious since for a generation, and were finding its way into bad practices everywhere because of a mortgage finance system with a couple of institutions at their core that begat bad practices everywhere. So I would be surprised if I could be anything other than concerned about everything that emanated in mortgage finance, from the origination, securitization, investor, from the lender to the homeowner. So I'm afraid your facts on that aren't right.
Well, we started a little bit late. We've made up that time, and we've gone well past the time that Governor Warsh had allotted to this. So I think we're going to
have to get ready for an interest rate meeting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hey, guys, was that helpful at all?
Yes, definitely.
Good.
Okay, it is 7:15 p.m. on October 28th still. We'll be going off the record.
Thank you very much.